This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. And a very happy Thanksgiving belatedly to you, Layla. How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, thank you. Wonderful. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you.
How was yours?
Good, good. And for our listeners, I want to point out that in case you missed it, I-C-Y-M-I. You know, it's a new acronym that you can find on Facebook. I-C-Y-M-I, in case you missed it. I posted a very nice article on things to be thankful for this Thanksgiving, so I thought I'd point that out.
Wonderful.
So check it out. Check it out.
Yeah.
And so this week, we're answering your questions as usual. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for your questions. We'll answer as many of them as we can. And before we get to questions, Layla, I don't know if you saw it, but there's recently been a bit of a buzz about something that we have been talking about for a really long time. And it usually works out that way. It's like, oh, you know, fish oil is beneficial. Oh, wow, we knew that. Okay. Vitamin E, yeah, you need more. Okay, we knew that. Chelation works. Oh, yeah, we knew that. We've been telling you that for a long time. This one, a series of articles that are based on a study that shows that you really, there is no one-size-fits-all diet. Lo and behold, what a revelation. Wow. Sounds like something you've been saying for a long time. But they base this on something very interesting, which is the glycemic load. Okay, you know, we often talk about the GI diet, the glycemic index diet, or the GL diet, because we feel that there's a benefit to slowing the absorption of carbohydrates, right? Mm-hmm. So we can actually compile statistics, we can do studies to see what the glycemic index is of, say, rice, brown rice versus table sugar. You know, okay, mm-hmm. or, you know, there are many other examples of things that are slowly absorbed versus things that are rapidly absorbed. But what they found in this study, and they looked at a number of individuals, and they found that the glycemic index and the glycemic impact of foods varied from person to person.
That is
How about that? Isn't that interesting? So in other words, so there was like, I think in the one article, they were talking about one person for whom tomatoes had a very significant glycemic impact. And we don't think of tomatoes traditionally as being something that, and this actually harkens back, you know, this may be actually even before your time, because I'm an old timer in this field. There was a guy named Dr. William Philpott, back in the 1970s. And what he urged patients to do, and they actually had several doctors doing this across the country, is they would give them glucometers, and they would say, go home and check your reaction to certain foods. And it would turn out that some people would have extraordinarily high blood sugars in relation to eating something like buckwheat, which was thought to be a whole grain. It would just go through the roof. Or potatoes would completely blow their blood sugar out of the water. Whereas maybe white bread wouldn't. You know, so and so he said, you have to individualize your diets to assess your reaction, and he thought this was on the basis of some sort of allergic reaction, that there was an allergic basis to this, but not truly like an allergy, like where you go into wheezing or you know, or hives or something, or have trouble breathing when you eat a food, an anaphylactic reaction or typical allergic reaction. But it was some sort of like an intolerance-like reaction where your pancreas didn't do well with certain foods. Mm-hmm. Interesting, huh?
Very interesting.
So this is a new thing, and I'm thinking of maybe this week I'll churn out an article to that effect.
I wonder if we shouldn't all have a glucose meter and see how we react to foods. This is very intriguing.
Yeah, it requires an exceptional patient. You have to be almost a little bit OCD to undertake this experiment on your own, you know, to say, okay, great, the doctor says, here's my glucometer. I'm going to challenge myself with, you know, various types of carbs, basically, and see which carbs really send my blood sugar into the stratosphere and which don't. So it's not like there's one glycemic index for everyone. And,
that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, that just proves that, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the glycemic index because I believe the glycemic load is more important at the end of the day.
Right.
So it's just more ammunition, really, against the glycemic index because it can be very confusing.
Yep.
You know, a baked potato will score high, a white bread will score high, but, you know, Häagen-Dazs ice cream will score low.
Right. And
that's confusing to a lot of people.
Well, that, you're talking about the index, right?
The index. I'm talking about the glycemic index.
Right. That's why we use the load concept a little more. But then the load concept doesn't really account for palatability. And, you know, another problem is, and I think this is actually the case for some of these very low-carb diets or high-fat diets, is that actually you can impair your insulin sensitivity by eating fats. Especially the wrong kind of fats. The wrong kind of fats may damage the receptors on your cells so that you become more insulin resistant. There is something to that.
Well, you know, insulin also goes up, not just in response to carbohydrates, but, you know, after a big Thanksgiving meal. Or any kind of big, heavy meal. Insulin will still rise. So, yeah, it's all interesting.
I thought it was the boredom from the company and the poor quality
and
of the
tryptophan
and the poor quality of the football gamesmanship this year that put me to sleep. But anyway, what do I know? Okay, so let's focus on questions. What do we got?
Yes, we've got a question from Michael, and this could be a very long answer. Michael writes, Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, since leaky gut syndrome can cause inflammation that can then lead to a variety of problems in different body systems, how do you, quote, treat patients with leaky gut system? Is giving them digestive enzymes and probiotics helpful? Are there specific strains of probiotics that would be especially helpful?
Okay. Well, that's a pretty big essay question. Why don't you start?
Yeah. Well, leaky gut syndrome, we treat that here at the Hoffman Center, is caused by a whole lot of things. Poor diet, stress, frequent use of NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, overuse of alcohol, things of that nature, cigarette smoking, toxin buildup, toxic burden, all of that can cause leaky gut syndrome. Leaky gut syndrome is also, you know, precedes a lot of autoimmune diseases, and this is basically agreed upon by so many integrative practitioners. Mm-hmm. So leaky gut system is something we often look for to see if a person is very allergic to a lot of foods for no good reason, has chemical sensitivities. A candida overgrowth can cause leaky gut syndrome. So it really depends on how the patient is presenting, how we would treat it. But there certainly we would add things like probiotics, maybe glutamine, to help heal the gut. If the leaky gut syndrome is caused by dysbiosis or candida or anything like that, we would give them antifungal type herbs and other micronutrients to help support all of that. And the probiotics, very interestingly, and I've spoken about this before, there is a school of thought that the best time to take a probiotic is on an empty stomach where the stomach acid is least, but other scientists say you should take it with food because the food will soak up all that acid in your stomach and then it won't interfere with the probiotic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of components to this. Yeah. You know, one of the most successful interventions for leaky gut is to take a patient off a key food that is the trigger. So it might be gluten, it might be dairy, and because the gut is reacting to that food, it becomes inflamed and microscopically porous. I mean, we don't see, you know, physical holes in the gastrointestinal tract. These are microscopic holes that permit toxins from the intestinal tract and undigested food proteins to go directly into the systemic circulation and create havoc. So that, you know, patients who have fatigue, fibromyalgia, skin conditions, many allergies, multiple chemical sensitivity, many food intolerances, these are patients that we might assess for leaky gut syndrome. And there's an interesting fact that, and I might have mentioned on a previous podcast, that the primary relatives of patients with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, even if they don't have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, they have a high incidence of excess intestinal permeability or leaky gut.
Wow.
So it's obviously there's a genetic component to it.
Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, if you're on the SAD diet or the standard American diet, 9 times out of 10, you're probably going to have some leaky gut as well.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so those
a
are,
lot of...
those are some of the components. And, you know, it is not a... I don't think we can give people a recipe or a protocol or one supplement that is going to do it because the leaky gut syndrome is the end product of a variety of imbalances, and they have to each be corrected. You know, the diet has to be modified, the flora has to be restored, bad pathogens in the gastrointestinal tract have to be eliminated, and we have to give soothing and regenerative nutraceuticals to the patient to begin the healing process and facilitate it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Michael, thank you for that great question.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, I've got a question from Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My father is 66. He has a history of heart disease and recently type 2 diabetes. He's controlling it with diet. His doctor found he was low in testosterone this summer and gave him 2 subsequent IM injections in August and September. Following both injections, his energy level dropped and he was extremely weak and tired. He continues to feel severe lethargy and weakness, causing significant difficulty walking and balancing, which he didn't have prior to these injections.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's really, that is a sort of bass-ackwards way of responding to testosterone. But I have to quarrel a little bit with the means of administration of testosterone. To me, injecting testosterone is mostly a moneymaker for doctors because the vast majority of our patients, maybe 95 or 98% of our patients, don't require injections, which we can charge for. But we can't charge for pharmaceutical, you know, medication, topical drugstore prescriptions of topical testosterone, but they're much better for patients because it's a more natural way of getting testosterone on a daily basis rather than one big shot that sends your testosterone through the roof and then it drops down. Usually if you want to get a steady state with injections, you have to give it every, you know, every week or something. And seldom is it administered that way. So not my favorite way of administering it, except in cases where men don't respond, the rare cases where men don't respond to the topical. And these are men who have very low testosterone or they're very fat, and the fat sops up all that testosterone that we give them, so we can't achieve optimal levels. I don't know what happens when, you know, it's almost like he's having a just backwards reaction to testosterone. Testosterone should energize him. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, actually, Kelly mentioned something else.
Yeah.
Prior to the third injection, his doctor discontinued the injections due to high hematocrit levels.
Oh, I get it. Okay. Okay, so this is another problem. Another problem with testosterone injected is that it tends to cause a high blood count. And a high blood count can cause sludging of the blood. You know, it's never having like red blood, you know, thin red blood running through your blood vessels that flows easily. It's like having, you know, Campbell's cream of tomato soup running through your blood vessels. And maybe there was some sort of circulatory impairment that occurred with that. But it shouldn't happen. It just, that's what injections do, and we don't usually see that effect when we use the topical. We watch blood counts. We want to make sure the men's, not just testosterone, if testosterone is too high, but if the blood counts are going up, that's not good because, you know, like low blood counts create problems. High blood counts create problems too. This is actually sometimes has to be treated with giving blood or medications to lower the blood count. It can be dangerous. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. I think the whole approach is wrong because to give testosterone injections to this man is, I think, the wrong way to go.
My only other thought, Dr. Hoffman, might be something, some preservative in the injection that he's reacting to.
Well, that's the other thing is that the other problem with testosterone injections is it's not natural testosterone. It's a methylated form of testosterone, which is synthetic. It's not seen in nature, and it may not have the same benefits. We use bioidentical natural testosterone, which can't be injected. It has to be taken as a topical. So, I don't know. This doctor doesn't seem to know too much about testosterone.
Yeah, and Kelly's wondering, are there any recommendations regarding nutrition supplements to...
Who knows? Who knows with this guy? Do you have any idea what's going on with this guy?
I have no idea. No, I don't know what's going on. I think you should get a full workup and rule out anything else.
Yeah.
But the way to increase testosterone naturally, Kelly wants to know, is, you know, first of all, exclude things that will lower testosterone, not getting enough sleep.
Or sleep
apnea.
The use
of alcohol, the use of marijuana, all of these, the use of too much sugar, belly fat, abdominal obesity, all of these things will lower testosterone.
Mm-hmm. Stress, aging.
Stress, aging.
Overweight.
And with belly fat.
Overweight, metabolic syndrome.
Yeah. That testosterone will be aromatized to estrogen, so that's the problem.
Yeah.
So, and strength training. Strength training wonderfully bolsters testosterone.
Right. And apparently, of all the exercises that seems to be most helpful for raising testosterone is the squat. Because you were dealing with the large muscles seems to generate testosterone production.
Yeah.
And maybe less some heroic aerobic exercise, you know, where you're running like, you know, 15 miles a day, that can sort of kill your testosterone. That can take it down a notch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no danger of that. Not me. I actually ran a couple. I did this stair climber this morning, which is it gets you out of breath really quick for about 15 minutes. And then I ran a couple of miles and then I did some light weights. And that for me is, that's a good workout. But just kind of keep things going, but not to exhaustion. So I can function and still talk during these podcasts because I got a lot of work to do today.
Oh, you know what else for Kelly's father? He should get his DHEA levels checked.
Indeed.
To see, you know, because that's the substrate where so many hormones are made.
But this is one of the, I think, the drawbacks to this genre of medical communication. It's sort of DIY, do it yourself. And I really don't have enough information on this guy to make a proper assessment. And yeah, his testosterone is low, but you know, there's a saying in clinical ecology or environmental medicine is when you're sitting on five tacks and you take one tack away, how much better do you feel? In other words, you know, we attack that testosterone thing, fix that, but the guy's, you know, we may not have fixed other things, or we may have thrown some other systems out of kilter because we didn't take a holistic or comprehensive approach to addressing his deficits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Kelly, best of luck with your dad.
Enough said.
Okay. Yeah. We've got a question from Robert. I have heard that vitamin K should be included for calcium absorption and bone growth. What's the recommended dose of vitamin K?
Well, I think you know as well
as I. So far as we know now, about 180 micrograms
per
day.
Right.
But it may be higher.
Mm-hmm.
It may be higher.
What do you think,
Dr. Hoffman?
According to some studies that I read, pretty good results were attained with 180 micrograms. Now, some supplements have 45 micrograms. This is, by the way, MK7, vitamin K. There's a little bit of confusion here because there are some vitamin K supplements out there, and they offer like milligram amounts, which is 1,000 micrograms, but not all vitamin K is the subtype of vitamin K called MK7. What you really want to make sure is that you get MK7 at 180 milligrams per day. That might require 290 microgram. I said microgram capsules.
Micrograms, yes.
Right, not milligrams.
Micrograms.
Or I think they now are starting to make 180 microgram capsules. So that would be the requisite amount for bone and probably for heart.
Yeah, as we're finding out more and more. This is a very important nutrient in heart health. To make sure that the calcium stays out of the coronary arteries, you need vitamin K.
Mm-hmm.
And just to let everybody know, MK7 is actually vitamin K2. That's what you want to take, vitamin K2. We get some other K from green leafies in small amounts and
that's
things
K1.
Like that.
That's K1.
That's K1, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is important, too. But and that K1...
So eat your green leafies, absolutely.
There's phyloquinone and menaquinone, and then there's... you know, I don't know what MK7 stands for, but it's the subtype.
Yeah, the menaquinone is K2. Yeah.
K2, right.
Yeah.
Vitamin K may also have cancer-preventive properties as well.
Wow. Wow, I haven't heard that one.
There's some people putting in IVs for cancer, but I'm not sure that that's the answer.
Mm-hmm. So vitamin K keeps the calcium in the bones where they're supposed to be, as opposed to, you know, causing obstruction in coronary arteries, possibly causing suspicious calcifications in soft tissue like breast tissue and things like that. So very important micronutrient.
Yep.
Thank you for your question, Robert. Okay. We have a question from Tracy. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I was considering dental implants. I have 5 coronary stents. Would this be a dangerous undertaking? My heart is very stable, and the stents were placed years ago.
Okay. When you have any kind of foreign body in you, whether it's a coronary stent, whether it's an artificial heart valve, whether it's a hip or a knee prosthesis, whenever you have any kind of extensive dental work or any kind of surgery, it's said that you need antibiotic prophylaxis. The reason being is that the mouth is dirty, and when you instrument the mouth, even with something as mild as a cleaning, and sometimes they really get in there. Layla, you know when they sometimes they do their cleaning, they get in there and they really clean deep around the gums. They dislodge bacteria, and that bacteria doesn't always go into the porcelain bowl in the dentist's office. It actually can sometimes cross the barrier. It's kind of like leaky mouth syndrome. You know, we talk about leaky gut syndrome. You actually may have porosity towards certain bacteria in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And through instrumentation, you can send those bacteria on a... remember that movie Incredible Journey, you know, where they shrank people and they put them through the, you know, body? I don't know, it's maybe before your time, too. But it's like a movie where they took a little submarine and shrank it down, and then they went traversing through the body. It's kind of a fun movie when I was a kid to watch. Well, the bacteria then go on this roller coaster ride throughout your body, and generally they don't stick because there are various ways that the body prevents stickiness. But on artificial surfaces, and this is one of the things that bedevils the prosthetic industry, is that these artificial surfaces actually form very nice landing pads for bacteria that are coursing through your body. And therefore, people with artificial valves can get heart valves, can get infections. Artificial joints may form biofilms, which create infections that are very hard to eradicate. It's just any surface acts as a sort of a gathering place for bacteria that go through the stomach circuit. So you need antibiotic prophylaxis. Is it inadvisable to do it because you have stents? Well, the only concern I would have is, you know, if you got extensive periodontal disease, you may want to really work hard on cleaning that up before you have the implants. You know, the one situation where we really don't want to see implants, and dentists now know this, is in women or men who've taken bisphosphonate drugs, drugs like Beneva, Actonel, and Fosamax, or Reclast, especially Reclast, because not just during the time of the use of the drugs, but for several years afterwards, the healing capacity of the jaw is diminished. And you can, through drilling into the jaw or instrumenting the jaw, you can trigger something horrible called ONJ, osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is literally a dying of the tissue of the jaw, which is irreversible and not treatable. Hmm. So so those are the issues. I think it's okay to
Tracy
have that
Tracy might
done.
Be better off with a bridge.
Well,
rather than implants.
You know, that's as I say, tell that to the Marines. You know, it's because a lot of people want the cosmetic benefits of the implant, and the bridges are unwieldy and not as satisfactory in terms of you know, eating. So I think you got to be careful. But
yeah,
you know, you may want to get to get a second opinion on this from someone who really is in the business. Talk to an integrative dentist, you know, a dentist who practices complementary dentistry, and see what they say. You know, the complementary dentist that I use here in New York, he does implants, but he's very careful when he does implants. And, you know, using the right material, there's also these issues of proper compatibility. You know, if you're putting in material that your body reacts to, they want to assess whether you might have, you know, it's a foreign material, and you actually want to make sure your body doesn't start to hyper react the towards the material and create an autoimmune reaction.
Yeah. And, you know, people with autoimmune conditions should probably be extra careful.
Yes, more cautious, exactly. So, I mean, this would be, like, say somebody has MS or lupus. This could be more of a problem. You know, it's just like breast implants. Breast implants can be well tolerated, but for patients with a propensity to autoimmune disease, I think just really ill-advised. Not a fan of breast implants.
Yeah.
Not at all a fan of. And, you know, I'm a guy. both aesthetically and from a medical standpoint, not a fan of those.
Yeah. Oh, Tracy, best of luck with your decision, and thank you for your question.
Thank you. Good question. All right. Okay. So let's pause. Hit the pause button because we are going to flip over to side two. We divide these podcasts into two parts. So what will be our next question in part two that listeners can look forward to?
Yeah, what is the downside of carrageenan?
Ah, good question. Mm. All right, coming up, part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast, our weekly Q&A with Layla. We will tackle that question and others. So stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.